is for the lead, 46-yarder. It's blocked! It's blocked, and it's picked up on the play by Ty Smith after getting blocked on the play by Cruikshank. He'll take it the distance, and that is a score! That is amazing! The block by Cruikshank! Ty Smith returns it, and the Titans have stunned the crowd here in Indianapolis.
For only the second time since 2007, with a blocked field goal, the first time since 2001 that had happened for the Tennessee Titans, your NFL franchise is a winner on the road against the Indianapolis Colts, 31-17, as they keep their playoff hopes alive. Now two games over 500 and one game back of the Houston Texans in the AFC South. This is Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Derek Mason, Braden Gall, Marquise Munson, everyone back from holiday vacation, fat and happy, I hope. Everybody feeling fat and happy because there's so much to discuss today. There's almost not enough time on the show today for all of the things that we need to discuss.
Yeah, you might be right about that. A lot of stuff went on this weekend.
No kidding.
College.
No kidding.
College might have been the most.
Alabama's done, boys. Sorry, Marquise.
Yeah,
we'll get to that in a minute.
Alabama is, you know, it was, I said, wow. It was a setup. You saw it coming. With the Alabama game, with the Titans game, you just felt that if they hang around long enough, maybe, just maybe, they can pull out a victory, you know, by a field goal. And lo and behold, the one guy that has been an Achilles heel for the Indianapolis Colts, he struck again. Adam Vinatieri.
I don't know. I'm surprised he made it through October on the roster.
Yes.
Much less through November on the roster.
I think they keep him. It's one of those deals with Adam Vinatieri, I think, that it's like.
He's better than Cairo Santos?
It's like something that you have for a long time that has been working, and then you know it's about to go, but you just want to keep it for as long as possible. But you know, you might as well just get a new one.
Marcus Mariota?
Exactly. Like, eventually it's going to go out. You just need to get a new one.
It seems like the Colts are just letting him walk on his own terms.
Absolutely.
But it's like, dude, you're losing games because of
well,
it.
Well, I will.
The last of the
I'm point, not going to say mean, that they lost the game he, because of Adam
the I know, one, but they lost games because
your point
of
is
it.
Valid, yeah.
The one that got blocked, it was low.
Nobody blocked
the first one. No, the last one. I was just nobody yeah. blocked the guy, and that
I,
was
I could have blocked that
yeah.
field goal.
I mean, how do you not block a guy that's standing in front of you? I just don't get it on field goal block. I just don't get it.
So we've got a monumental season turnaround for Jeremy Pruitt and the Tennessee Volunteers. Although there was a little bit of ugliness at the end of the Tennessee Vanderbilt game, so we have that story to get to. Alabama, for the first time in the college football playoff era, the Alabama Crimson Tide will not be a part of the college football playoff. That's a huge story. We've got coaches getting fired because a player decides to urinate in the end zone on Thursday night, goodness. Which is one of the it's a fake urination there.
But
he cost his team the Egg Bowl, and frankly, he might have changed the like one guy got fired, Matt Luke at Ole Miss. The other guy didn't. It might have been different had they not called that penalty. That's how crazy that game was. You've got Missouri firing a coach. We're not sure if USC's firing a coach or not. Mm-hmm. There's a conflicting report out of California, and the Predators. Kyle Turris' watch is still ongoing every single night that the Nashville Predators get onto the ice. David Poyle has a long explanation without actually saying anything about why Kyle Turris isn't playing. We'll get to that. The list of things we've got to cover today on the show is extraordinary. So some of these things we'll have to get into tomorrow because the Tennessee Titans going two games up on 500 to get to 7-5 with a road win over the Indianapolis Colts. Again, only the second time in 16 trips north to Indianapolis have the Titans come away with a win. Yesterday was just the second time. Both of those, of course, coming against Jacoby Brissett. Marcus beat Jacoby Brissett up in Indianapolis a couple years ago. No wins over Andrew Luck, of course. And the first time since 2001 that they returned a blocked kick for a field goal. That's almost 300 football games in between that. And just Derrick Henry, Ryan Tannehill, it's the same story. They're figuring out ways to win. And this one felt different to me, Derek, for one reason. Mm-hmm. It's the Colts. So there's a mental thing there with the Colts. And they got off to a bad start with the fumble, multiple fumbles. Mm-hmm. I thought the Colts had a chance to put their foot on the Titans' throat in the first half. They go up 17-7 right out of the break in the second half. And I thought, here we go again. This is going to be another Colts-Titans game. And give those guys a lot of credit because they battled back and ended up winning with relative ease with some fourth quarter heroics.
Yeah, you just saw the potential of a shift. That field goal, there was two plays in that game, and I think they kind of changed it for the Titans. Had the field goal went in, I think they would have went back to, here we go again. Had the Colts went up 20-17, I think the thought on that sideline, like, seriously, after we've done all of this and we're still down 17-20, oh my goodness, can we ever beat this team? But they get the blocked field goal. Another play in the game, maybe because I had the TV, I had a few things going on. There were things going on yesterday. I was out getting something to eat, and I couldn't hear what was actually going on. The catch or no catch or whatever it was.
Oh, we'll get to that.
By Brown. I don't know what they said. Just tell me, and I'll finish with what I got to say. Did they say the recovery was out of bounds?
So, okay,
I couldn't hear it, so I'm like, did they say, was that not a catch?
Oh, no, we've got to spend an entire offseason essentially reliving Rule 15, Section 3, Article 2, Item 1, Note 2. That is the rule that applies to that particular play.
Uh-huh. Those two plays, I think, really kind of sort of changed the game
to me. What's interesting is
because they were late.
What's interesting is the play probably would have helped the Titans, giving them a first down, we all assumed in the media that they called it incorrectly and ruled it incorrectly on the field, that they should have placed the ball at the spot of the catch. They actually implemented the rule correctly. The rule seems awfully dumb.
We'll have to
discuss again.
Because I couldn't hear it.
Rule 15, Section 3, Article 2, Item 1, Note 2. You don't know everything about that rule, Derek?
Hell no. I think they had to look in a book for that rule.
Yeah, and they had to print it out and send it to all the media.
Absolutely.
What I was shocked by was how the media reacted yesterday on social media. Like, everyone's completely baffled by Al Riveron's explanation of this. He actually explained it quite well. I think the rule, you know, he explained and they implemented the rule. They implemented the rule correctly. It just feels like it's sort of a dumb rule that they probably need to readdress. So here is the rule that I keep referring to. Again, for those of you at home, Rule 15, Section 3, Article 2, Item 1, Note 2. I mean, obviously, everyone knows that one. When a ruling of incomplete is changed to a catch and fumble, the ball will be awarded at the spot of the recovery to the team that recovers the ball in the immediate continuing action. The Titans didn't do that. If there is no clear recovery, the ruling on the field stands even if the ball was clearly caught. The ruling on the field was incomplete. So if the rule says you have to go back to the original ruling on the field, which is incomplete pass, then they called it correctly and placed it correctly. It just in the moment felt awfully stupid. And the rule itself, I think, needs to be changed because if it's a catch, then you need to rule it a catch. And then wherever forward progress was when he fumbled is where the ball should be placed if there's no recovery. Why isn't it like a ball bouncing out of bounds?
I don't know what a catch is anymore. I really don't. That was clearly a catch.
Yeah, and
he caught it, he tucked it,
yes.
Got two steps, and he got it ripped out. I don't know what a catch is.
They ruled it a catch. That's the problem.
So did they say Indianapolis didn't recover?
They said there was no clear recovery.
Huh?
And if there was no clear recovery. Now I actually agree with this. So this is, again, we're already
the
off
the guy
topic
had
here, but
the ball in his hand. In his hand. Do you have to then tuck it?
No, it's because the whistle had blown and Jonnu Smith clearly stopped. I thought that, and this is what makes this call so complicated, and I actually think they did it correctly. It's just sort of messing with everybody's mind. So what I heard is the ball's just kind of sitting there on the ground, and the whistle blows like so many times. And I went back and watched it like 15 times trying to make sure this is correct in my head. I think they called it correctly because the whistle had blown and the Titans players had clearly stopped both sides had clearly stopped, except for one guy.
Janu couldn't get that ball.
I'm not saying
he was in the position that he was in. He hit the ball. Actually, Janu hit it.
And he pushed another guy.
But he had no way of getting that ball.
I think they ruled it no clear recovery. And they might have used the out-of-bounds area as an excuse for this. But I don't. If you blow the whistle that many times and the ball's just sitting there spinning, mm-hmm. I don't know how you expect both teams to equally go after it and have a quote clear recovery. Like that's my problem. Is that I actually think they implemented the rule correctly because it's a really difficult call. If the whistle blows and the ball's just sitting there and no one's recovered it yet, how can you fault a team for not going after it because the whistle's blown a bunch of times?
But if you watch that play. Janu had no way of getting it. Actually, Janu helped the guy at getting the ball because when the ball hit the ground,
I don't disagree
he hit
with
it, and then that allowed the guy to get it. The NFL, to me, these things that happen, they should just let it play out and then go back to replay and say, you know what, it was a fumble or it wasn't a fumble. Because when you do that, then everybody's wondering, like, what's really going on here? Because that was a catch. But then
now you're saying
it wasn't a clear fumble. Everybody's scratching their head like, huh?
Well,
seriously?
That's what makes this rule so bizarre, is that they're saying it's a catch and they're saying it's a fumble. But because there is no clear recovery, quote unquote, that's their definition. And I actually am okay with that definition, because if the whistle blows and no one's recovered it, I'm okay with you then stopping the play and saying, nope, nobody recovered it. Now, the whistle had blown so many times, and the recovery was immediately thereafter. And so it is a very complicated, nuanced, difficult situation. We're already bogged down in this because it's a strange rule, and it probably needs to be changed, and the NFL needs to visit.
That'd be another one the NFL changed.
They need to visit in the offseason. But it actually didn't affect the outcome of the game. It could have. Mm-hmm. It could have affected the outcome of the game because you probably took a first down away from the Titans. Again, it ended up being 2nd and 7 instead of
they ended up putting the ball on that series. I think had it been considered a catch,
it would have been like 2nd and inches.
And no one recovered it and they placed the ball right there, then the Titans could have continued a first down possibly. Or if Indianapolis would have recovered it, they would have been closer to their side or the Titans end of the field. But I thought those two plays sort of kind of changed the mentality or changed kind of what was going on in the game.
Had it been ruled a Colts recovery, it would have changed the game in a huge way.
Yeah, in a Colts, sort of in a Colts favor. But the defense played well. I thought the offensive line played well in the first half. In the second half, they just, I don't know what happened to them. I think Indianapolis started to figure some things out and made some adjustments, and they started getting to the quarterback. This season is not this season if two people are not playing the way they are.
And we'll get to those
Absolutely.
Two after the break. And I have a feeling I know where you're going because I think I'm going to totally agree with you. I love disagreeing with you. I'd rather disagree with you. It's more fun for me. But I think I'm going to totally agree with you on this. So we'll get to those two guys because there are some guys that need a lot of credit for what took place last night. Titans win 31-17 in Indianapolis. Again, only the second win in that city against that franchise since 2007, 2-14 in their last 16 trips up north. But they get a win, and they're one game back at the Texans, and they're two games up on .500. We'll return right here on Morning Drive. Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 again. The Tennessee Titans beat the Indianapolis Colts 31-17 over the holiday weekend yesterday, and now sit at 7-5 and trail only the Pittsburgh Steelers for the final wild card. They are tied at 7-5. Pittsburgh has a 6-3 conference record in the AFC. The Titans sit at 5-4. The Titans moved to 2-2 in the division after back-to-back division wins against Jacksonville and Indianapolis. Two huge wins, and then of course two with the Houston Texans, who they are chasing. Who, by the way, got a huge win last night.
Yes.
On Sunday night against the New England Patriots. I know a lot of Titans fans are rooting for the New England Patriots in that situation. The Patriots offense not trending in the right direction right now.
Not at all.
However, you said that before the break, the Tennessee Titans, who have won now 5 out of 6, who have won 3 straight, would not be where they are today without two players, and I have a feeling I know where you're going with this.
Well, I know,
it's Logan Ryan.
Exactly.
By the way, he was great yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
He's been exceptional all season.
The secondary is playing much better.
Shorthanded. Without Adoree Jackson yesterday, who gets hurt. And
that's
Malcolm
going
Butler.
To be, did he return? I didn't notice if he, I think he returned in the game yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
He did, but he was in street clothes going into the locker room. So.
So that's not going to be good for them heading into Oakland. Two people. One is obviously the running back, Derrick Henry. This guy has been a tank for the Tennessee Titans. I said this last week, and I'm going to continue to say it. He is the best runner in the National Football League. He's running behind his pads. He's running downhill. He's running physical. And you just saw yesterday that, man, you just like, man, he's on the verge of breaking one. I know his long was only 34 yards, but you're like, man, he's on the verge of breaking like a 50 or 60 yard of the way he's running. But what he does is he allows the Tennessee Titans to control the clock. He beats up on that defensive line. He beats up on those linebackers and the secondary guys. And then eventually they're going to have to start making business decisions come the fourth quarter. And when they hit him, he gets yards after contact, which is huge. He's one of the best, if not the best back in the National Football League in regards to yards after contact. So Derrick Henry, I think, it won because of him, because of the way he's running the football. The Titans are able to stay within the framework of their offense. They get to get in third and manageable. I think yesterday they averaged third and five, even though they were not great in third down, but they were not third and eight, third and nine. I think they averaged third and five or six, which is where you want to be as an offense because then your playbook is wide open. The second guy.
Hey, before you get to that, Derrick Henry, 68 carries, 496 yards, and five touchdowns in his last three games. He's been over 140 yards in each of those three games. The Colts had gone 29 consecutive games without giving up a 100-yard rusher. Mm-hmm. And Derrick Henry had 100 yards with 9 minutes to go in the third quarter.
Yeah.
And he only had 12 or 13 carries at that time. So I'm sitting there going, okay, you're averaging 9 yards a carry, dude. Mm-hmm. Let's give you the football some more. And they gave him the football a bunch in the third and fourth quarter. In these three games that they've won against the Chiefs, against the Jags, and now against the Colts, he's averaging 7.3 yards a carry on 68 carries. It's 500 yards in three games. Huge.
Again, he's the best runner in the National Football League right now.
And over the last 16, how about these numbers from scrimmage? From scrimmage over his last 16 games, so that'd be a season, right? 1,946 yards, 20 touchdowns. That is his 16-game, the last 16 games Derrick Henry has played. Almost 2,000 yards of offense.
You know what that equates to? $11 million a year. That's what it equates to. Seriously, they're going to have to pay the man his money. And the byproduct is they are winning games because of their playing a brand of football that they want to play. And then Ryan Tannehill. I think what Ryan has been able to do, he's taken his offense and he's made it his. He's taken his offense and everyone feels comfortable with him in the huddle. I think everyone trusts that when they go out there, no matter what point of the game they're in, if they're down three, if they're up three, Ryan's going to do the right thing. He's going to put them in the right position to complete a pass, to move the ball down the field. That pass to Khalif Raymond was a dime.
Yeah,
I mean, the play action, great call by Arthur Smith because they're jumping on the run. They're jumping on the run.
In the postseason, in the postgame, Vrabel said it was his best call of the entire season. Singular play call.
I think he might have been.
You know what? It was a brilliant call. It was a brilliant catch by Khalif Raymond to lay out like that over your shoulders. Not an easy catch. And then a brilliant throw by Ryan Tannehill. It was just one of those plays where everything worked the way it was supposed to.
Exactly.
At the right time against the right coverage. There was fantastic execution from the quarterback, and it basically put the dagger in the back of the Indianapolis Colts.
This has been somewhat a redemption for Ryan and sort of for Derek as well. The last 16 games, this because he was benched and because people were questioning whether, you know, he is that type of back. Is he all burnt out from what they, you know, how many times they ran to him in Alabama?
Himself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, you know, it's now he's showing what he is capable of doing. Ryan Tannehill had it. People said he's just a backup. You know, his stint in Miami, that's who he is as a quarterback. And it may be that might be the case. But he comes here, he doesn't make a fuss, He sits behind Marcus, and when his time comes,
he's ready.
He's prepared and ready to play. He stepped in like he was a starter day one, and he has not looked back. Now, things could change. I understand that. But from this up until this point, I think he has been everything and more than what the Titans thought he would be.
I'll go further than that. I don't think there is a single Titans fan or Titans coach or member of that administration or Titans player or anybody on the planet that saw this level of production coming, because there's nothing in his career that indicated that this was going to be coming. I'm fine if you say, you know what, I thought Tannehill should have started over Marcus. I was right about that.
I just said he needed a change of venue. Maybe it works out for him.
And I got no problem. Listen, if you were back there in August saying, listen, I think Ryan Tannehill's the better player. I think he gives the team a better chance to win. I think he's good. I'd like to see him get a chance. That's fine. You're vindicated. You were right. There's no question about that. Those of us who thought Marcus should be the starter, we were wrong. There's no question about that in this season. But don't tell me you saw 5-1 coming with the highest quarterback rating in the NFL. He's averaging 9.1 yards per attempt, which would shatter his career high, and is leading the NFL. He is playing the best football of his entire career. So you can't tell me that you saw the best football of his entire career coming. Nobody saw that coming. But he's been great, and you can't argue that. Now, the fumble issue is going to be a major issue.
They got to get that.
He cannot continue to listen. They were sacked six times. That's not all his fault. Some of them were his fault. Just like with Marcus, not all the sacks were his fault. Some of them were. There's still issues there. But here's the numbers that matter the most to me. They've scored 35 points against Kansas City, 42 points against Jacksonville, 31 points against Indianapolis. Ryan Tannehill has thrown the ball 19 times, 18 times, and 22 times.
That's where they want him to be.
That is what works. It is not a coincidence that they are scoring more points, because while Ryan Tannehill, you don't need Ryan Tannehill, or Marcus for that matter, to throw the ball 40 times. That's not what this offense needs to do. They need Derrick Henry doing what he's doing right now, and they need efficiency from the quarterback. And right now, at 9.1 yards per attempt for Ryan Tannehill, number one in the NFL, that is efficiency. I'd much rather have 19 efficient passes than 39 inefficient passes. And I like that balance is what's going to help this team potentially make the playoffs.
No, you're right. And this is something that that Arthur Smith has been wanting to do. This is how they envision this offense to be. I think that's why they hired Arthur Smith. One, because of his rapport with Marcus, and his knowledge of the offense. And then, two, they were going to play a brand of football that Mike Vrabel loves playing. I think both of them think alike. We're going to play in a box, and we're going to run the football. We're going to be physical, and we're going to play action and throw it. We're going to play hard-nosed, tough defense and get turnovers. And for the most part, at least the last three games, that's what they've been. They've been a run. They've been an efficient offense, and they've done it because they've been able to run the football, and they've been able to use the play action to their benefit. Because right now, I don't think there's, like you said, there's not a better quarterback if you're talking efficiency. I don't think there's a better, maybe Baltimore's, but I don't think there's a better offense from an efficient standpoint, what they're doing.
I'm not going to go that crazy.
Considering who they are playing.
Yeah, yeah.
They are doing exactly what they want to do, okay, which is run the football, manage the quarterback, but give him opportunities to make plays. And the quarterback, Ryan Tannehill, has been able to do just that. And guys have made plays for him. Khalif Raymond made plays for him. We've seen Brown make plays for him. We see Davis, Janu. These guys have made plays for him in the passing game.
Derrick Henry,
that has allowed them to do some things.
Derrick Henry caught a pass where Derrick Henry was facing the quarterback downfield. He was like six yards downfield. Ryan Tannehill threw a little dump off to him, and I was like, wait a second.
I thought his limit was like three.
I thought it was like a half a yard. As long as he's at the line or behind it, he's fine. Ryan Tannehill now with 113.9 quarterback rating, number two in the NFL behind only Kirk Cousins. Again, as I mentioned, you guys know me. Give me that efficiency.
The two quarterbacks, Kirk Cousins and Ryan Tannehill.
give me all of your efficiencies. I want the efficiencies, y'all. Give me yards per play on offense and defense. Give me yards per attempt as a quarterback. It's all about.
Who would have ever thought that?
It's about max. This is what I always talked about with Marcus. It's the reason I never liked touchdowns to interception ratio and total yards per game. Like, all that stuff's nice and cool for fantasy. What's great is when you throw the ball every time for 9.1 yards per attempt. I want efficiency. And Ryan Tannehill's been efficient. Now, he's also been sacked 20 times in six starts. He's also thrown, what, three interceptions, fumbled it. Mm-hmm. He has started six games, guys, and he's fumbled in every single one of them. So they're going to have to fix those problems if you want to beat teams like Houston and New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? They've accomplished everything they need to accomplish, and today's a positive day
mm-hmm.
when it comes to the Titans because they won. They beat the Colts, something we haven't seen, we don't feel like, in forever. And now we get to the other side of the equation, which is the Nashville Predators. We'll get to them and their holiday weekend as well as the Tennessee Vols. What happened in Knoxville, all of that when we return. Morning Drive, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. So the Titans win 31-17 over the Colts. They move to 7-5 now, just a tiebreaker away from being in the NFL playoffs. How about that, boys? Derek Mason, Braden Gall here on Morning Drive. The Nashville Predators, of course, they lose to Vegas by giving up the game-tying goal with less than a second to go in regulation, which is insane. They then lose in overtime, but they do get a point out of that one. So after bouncing back with two wins against St. Louis last week, they lose to Vegas on Wednesday night in overtime. They then come back and beat Carolina on the road, something they have not been able to do at all. They go 3-0 on Friday night to beat Carolina. They come back Saturday and lose 3-0 to Florida. Not as much shame in that one right there on a long holiday road trip with the Florida Panthers, who are, by, I believe, second in their division right now in the Eastern Conference. But, you know, a mixed bag. They did collect 7 out of 10 possible points since the losing streak. They have been better. But it feels silly to sort of try to analyze all that's going on. Rocco Grimaldi's playing really well. Nick Bonino and Philip Forsberg still leading the team in goals. Like, Yossi and Ellis are just on a tear right now on offense. I mean, there's lots of things we could discuss, but it all seems overshadowed by the fact that Kyle Turris still hasn't played in any of these games. And David Poile, David Poile gave us a long, if you read Adam Vingan's story in The Athletic, long explanation from David Poile saying, listen, this is nothing more than a true lineup decision by Peter Laviolette trying to give the Predators a best chance to win. I do appreciate David Poile. I think he is an honest man. I think he's a good man. I think he says what he thinks, and I appreciate the candor normally from David Poile. And while he is being very honest about what he says to us about Kyle Turris, the thing that keeps sitting in my mind, though, is that there still has not been an answer as to why. Predators fans want to know why Victor Arvidsson got hurt against St. Louis, was out for a chunk of time, and you have the third highest paid forward on your team, Kyle Turris, making $6 million, sitting on the bench in exchange for guys that you're calling up from the Milwaukee Admirals. And so we get it, Peter Laviolette and David Poile and everyone else with the Nashville Predators. We get it that he is not giving you the best chance to win right now and that it is a lineup decision. Keep saying that all you want to, guys. We hear you. We understand what you're saying. The question Predators fans want to know is why. Why does he not give you the best chance to win? Why does Daniel Carr give you a better chance to win? Why does Matthew Olivier give you a better chance to win? Why is Kyle Turris not playing? Those, not just that it's a lineup decision and he doesn't give you a good chance to win. We obviously understand that that's what Peter Laviolette is doing, trying to win hockey games. The reason fans are frustrated about this right now, and media as well, is that there's no why. Fans want to know why.
No, they do. And, you know, it's I know it's frustrating to watch it as a fan in a sense of they don't know why, because, you know, he did start the season off pretty good. He did have a lull in there where he wasn't playing well, but the whole team was not playing well. That whole 7-game skid wasn't because of all solely on Kyle Turris's back. So everybody had a hand in that. Now, maybe he, you know, was playing the worst of them all and you felt you had to do something. But even with that, you know, there hasn't been a clear cut explanation on why, you know, why he isn't playing even after Victor Arvidsson goes down for 7 weeks. You choose to bring in guys that doesn't have the experience that Kyle Turris have. You choose to bring them up and insert them in the lineup while Kyle Turris sits on the sideline. I know Kyle Turris has to be frustrated right now. either the frustration is, you know, why aren't you playing me? Or the frustration is, hey, listen, that seven-game skid, like I said, wasn't all my fault. Let me get back in here. Let me get back into a groove and then go from there. So, I mean, Lavi and Poyo can, you know, they're not going to get too far into the weeds on why he's not playing. But it's just, it's unfortunate because I think we talked when Victor went down that, okay, is this when Terrence is going to play? Yeah. Will he play now? Because it seemed like it opened up an opportunity for him to play now.
Yeah, listen, it's their, as we said last week, it's Peter Laviolette's prerogative to say whatever he wants to say. Well, guess what? It's the media and the fans' prerogative to respond however they want to respond.
Exactly.
And if you're going to act a little petulant and sort of be snarky and toothy and cheeky about it, right? Like, oh, it's just a lineup decision. Again, I agree with him. That's a discussion we can have. Does Calateras give you a better chance to win? The answer is no. Daniel Carr does. That's why Peter Laviolette's playing him. Again, the quote from David Poile, I'm certainly not trying to say this is a good situation or anything close to being a perfect situation. It's a roster decision. Peter Laviolette is our coach, and he will do anything to win a hockey game. He's putting his best foot forward, in this case, his best lineup, every night. That's his job. That's all I can ask from him. I can absolutely look you in the eye and tell you there's nothing to this other than the roster decision of what we think and specifically our coaching staff feels is our best lineup for every game. And I guarantee you, 100% guarantee you, that it's going to change many times during the year. I'm very confident that Kyle's going to get a chance to play. Hopefully, he's in a position to take advantage of it, and we turn the page. There's nothing fair or equal in this business, so I can't operate like that or what have you. You've just got to make the right decisions. A lot of them are highly unpopular. It is what it is, and we're just trying to win.
Go
I like
back,
all of that.
No,
but
go back to
still
the...
Still haven't told us why he doesn't give you a better chance to win.
Go back to the giving... What is it? Did he say give, hopefully given the opportunity?
This is the... You're right. You picked up exactly on the line that I would have as well, where he says, I am very confident that Kyle's going to get a chance to play. Hopefully, he's in a position to take advantage of it. That is sort of putting some pressure on Kyle Turner.
Exactly. And that's saying that he wasn't doing what they were asking him to do when he was playing.
Clearly, he's not playing.
Yeah. And he was, because when they were on this seven-game skid, there was a lot of people that were not playing well. So maybe, just maybe, he was the guy, knowing what his past was, meaning when he, you know, his slump last year, that they didn't have the patience to sit there and wait on him. They didn't have the patience to sit there and wait on him like they probably would have another guy.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so, again, my question to Peter Laviolette is, why does Kyle Turris not give you the better chance to win? That's what I want to know. I'm assuming it has to do with standing in front of the net, being physical, playing a heavier brand of hockey. I'm left to only assume and speculate, which all is common sense stuff here, but I think the reason people are frustrated is that you guys are being, you know, Peter Laviolette's being Peter Laviolette about it. He's being pretty cheeky about it, and if he wants to do that, he's entitled to do that. He's the coach, but the fans want to know, why is Kyle Turris not giving you a better chance to win? Does it help his trade value by sitting on the bench? Maybe not. There are teams that are struggling right now in the NHL that could use it. They maybe could use a scoring boost from a top six forward. Montreal Canadiens, for example, after losing a bunch of games. So does he being out
but
there...
But does anybody want him now?
And that's... obviously not. So, I mean, his own team doesn't want him right now. Yeah. So we'll see how this plays out. But until there is resolution on this, or it changes, we're still so early in the season that the wins and losses are important, but they're not as important as what does this roster look like heading into the playoffs in March and April. And that's where we're at right now, is looking at Kyle Turris, and he's the top story until something else happens. Huge stories in college football, as we have three coaching vacancies now in the SEC, one of the greatest in-season turnarounds in SEC history, and the Alabama Crimson Tide will not be in the playoff. All of that happened this weekend. We'll get to all of the latest news around the SEC when we return right here on Morning Drive.
I want to thank the fans that stuck through lots of rain delays. Wasn't the best weather in the world, but our fan base hung in there, stuck with us. It was a great send-off for these seniors, starting with a Vol walk, a chance to run through the tee for the last time. I know it meant a lot to these guys. These guys have put a whole lot of energy and effort in getting Tennessee football back to where it needs to be. I can't say enough about the players, the seniors, the leadership that they've provided throughout the course of the year. You know, we were 1-4, and probably nobody gave us much hope. But these guys stayed the course, stuck together. It's a credit to our coaching staff, our assistant coaches, for having a plan.
You're listening to Morning Drive live from the Wholesale Link studio, powered by RumbleOn.com. That's Jeremy Pruitt, by the way, of your Tennessee Volunteers, finishing 7-5 after a win over Vanderbilt over the holiday weekend. We will get to the Juwan Jennings conversation, which I think will be an interesting one, and we will want your involvement in that coming up in hour number two. So probably around 7:30-ish or so, we will get into the Juwan Jennings conversation. But there are so many headlines coming out of the SEC that it's hard to get into that discussion right now. The number one topic for the Tennessee Volunteers, however, is how well this defense has developed, how well the young players have developed. The offensive line has come along. They are now beating teams they are supposed to. They finished 5-3 in the SEC with a win over Vanderbilt. You know, Trey Smith with some comments after the game saying it feels great to have the natural order of things in the state of Tennessee back to normal a little bit with a win over Vanderbilt after the way Vanderbilt has controlled this rivalry. A critical win, now 7-5 after an 0-2 start. You can allow yourself to think, man, God, what if we had just beaten Georgia State and BYU, we'd be sitting at 9-3 right now, which would be incredible. But you have to give credit for the turnaround. Now, I will say this, not one of those teams has a winning SEC record that you beat in the SEC. Kentucky, mm-hmm. Missouri, Vanderbilt, Mississippi State, South Carolina, and none of them have a winning record in the SEC. Only one of them has a winning overall record, and that's Kentucky. But beating the teams you're supposed to beat is a new thing for the Tennessee Volunteers, and congratulations on one of the best turnarounds I've seen in SEC history, going from 0-2 to 7-5.
Well, they did exactly what they were supposed to do. If you look at their last half of their schedule, now the first half didn't go the way that they thought it would, the way many predicted it would. But I think a lot of people saw this as a, looking at their schedule, saw it as a possible 7-win team, 6-7, maybe pull out 8 wins. Well, you know, they started off slow at 1-4, but then they kind of, you know, put their foot on the gas pedal and they started to figure some things out. Now, granted, yeah, they played at South Carolina, UAB, UK, Missouri, and Vandy, but those are games they were losing last year. You know, those are games that sort of lined up in the same order last year, minus probably UAB, and they lost some of those games. So
almost all of them.
Yeah. So now, instead of losing them, they're winning them. So regardless of, you know, who the opponent is, we know this is a different team because now they are winning those games.
Yeah.
Last year they wasn't. The year before they were not. So they're beating teams they're supposed to beat. They got one game in there where they, you know, I don't know if the Mississippi game, UK game probably is the game that. Yeah.
You needed a goal line stand in the fourth quarter to beat Kentucky. You needed some really good defensive plays and defensive series and stops against Missouri on the road, mm-hmm. because that game was close. The defense in the second half against South Carolina was exceptional. You know, UAB only scored a touchdown, mm-hmm. and Vanderbilt, you know, unfortunately, Keyshawn Vaughn, probably in his last game as a Vanderbilt Commodore, you know, did not play a lot because mm-hmm. he got hurt, I guess, on that weird play at the beginning of the game and didn't really play. So unfortunately, they weren't really ever in the game, even though they got, you know, even though they scored in the second half to make it look better. The weather was obviously a huge factor. And again, the Juwan Jennings incident on the sideline, we will address it. We will get to it. We will have our opinions on whether or not he meant to step on a guy's head or not. We will get to all of that because I want some fan interaction on that one. We don't have a ton of time right now, but we'll get to that mm-hmm. coming up next hour. I think you look around the SEC, and in the Egg Bowl, you have one of the most bizarre penalties in the history of the game to cost Ole Miss a game. Well, it also cost Matt Luke his job. He's now been fired. Barry Odom on Saturday was relieved of his mm-hmm. duties, the head coach at Missouri. So now there are 3 openings along with Arkansas in the SEC. No real idea how good those jobs really are right now. They're probably the 5th best job, Arkansas and Ole Miss, 5th and 6th best jobs in the West. Missouri's probably the 5th or 6th best job in the East. They're not great jobs that are available, but there will be three new coaches. And I think the biggest story in the SEC all weekend is that the Alabama Crimson Tide will not be in the playoff this year for the first time since the playoff started. And that is as big a story as I can remember in the SEC. Alabama, not invited to the party this year.
They are outside of the top five for the first time since, what, 07, somewhere around there? And, I mean, losing two games at Alabama is a disaster season.
I mean, basically, yeah.
They lost two games, and it's a disaster.
Well, and this whole, like, suckification of sports where they're like, oh, you know, if you're not elite, you just automatically suck. There's a big difference between sucking and being not great, right? Like, Alabama's defense is still statistically pretty decent. It's one of the top 15 or 20 defenses in college football. It's just not elite. But it doesn't suck. Like, oh, Auburn sucks. Like, I hear from national people a lot. Oh, they suck. That sucks. Well, no, I mean, they're 10-2, and they still scored 45 points on Auburn's defense with a backup quarterback.
If Tua's playing, they win that game. I believe they win that game. Yeah, 100%. If Tua's playing, they are winning that game.
Let's get to the end of the game, which, of course, is where Nick Saban gets outsmarted and probably hates himself. And that is that Gus Malzahn runs a punter out onto the field. Alabama stops at Auburn, 4th and 4. They're going to get the ball back with a little over a minute to go with a chance to go down the field and score. They hadn't really been stopped on offense all night. And Gus Malzahn, old sneaky Gus, runs the punter out there. It forces Nick Saban to sort of react in the moment and switch his return unit for his defense because Bo Nix is lined up in the protection spot on the punt. I don't believe they were ever going to run that snap, so I think Nick Saban outsmarted himself maybe to some degree. Here was Nick Saban in his response to how the game ended.
You know, I really feel that it was pretty unfair play at the end of the game. They substituted a punter as a wide receiver, so we put the punt team in, and then when the quarterback was still in there, we tried to put the defense back in. Thought they should have given us a little more time to substitute and get Waddle out as a returner. We get called for 12 guys on the field.
Why, Coach? Why do you get more time over every other team in the history of the world? Why do the officials give Alabama more time to substitute? You screwed up, Coach Saban.
Yeah, we didn't know this was going to happen, so just hold everybody.
It's
hold
not
up
fair.
Real quick.
Not
no.
fair.
No, no, but to his defense.
You substituted
no, no, no.
a punter.
No, no,
oh.
to his defense.
No, there's no defense.
No, no, no. To his defense, this is college football, and because this is the pro league too. When you make a college, not necessarily pro, because pro they do it, but they do it, but then they give a little leeway because you little trickery in there because Bill Belichick does it and everybody goes haywire. But in college football, when you do make a substitution, I've seen this across the board, so it's not just Alabama. When you do make a substitution, you are allowed to get the right people in that substitution.
They did.
No. What I'm saying is this. They put in they put in their
punter as
their punter as their players out. So if I'm Coach Saban, then I am saying, let me get the proper people give me enough time to get the proper people on the field.
That's what I'm saying.
He didn't notice it until after he sent his guys out. And then he was trying to send everybody else in and they called him for 12 men.
Yeah, so again,
I'm just saying, this is not for the Alabama faithful or those that hate Alabama. But he is correct.
No, he's not.
No. He is correct. I've seen a number of games, more than my share of college football games, where the guy sits there and he makes sure everybody is in the game.
They already did that.
They're supposed to be in there.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. That already happened on the play. Like Gus Malzahn.
No, I was sitting there watching and I'm like,
he substitutes the punter. And at which point Alabama then is legally allowed and the officials have to allow Alabama to substitute. So Alabama did. They brought their punt team on. Then they realized, after making the substitution, crap, Bo Nix is in the game.
Well, but mind you.
Then they tried to substitute a second time. Mm-hmm. And the referee is under no obligation to allow you to substitute a second time. They're under an obligation to allow you to substitute the first time. And Nick Saban substituted the first time because he put his punt return team out there. They got outsmarted because Bo Nix was still in the slot.
But was it truly a substitution?
Yes.
Because
it was a changing
because the first one isn't a substitution. It's fourth down, so I'm bringing in my unit.
It's a substitution.
That's
a substitution.
That is not. That's considered a change of play. You change.
Yeah,
I'm bringing,
it's called a substitution.
It's not necessarily a substitution. It's third down. Everybody knows on fourth down, unless it's like fourth and inches.
Dude, if I put 11 offensive linemen on the field, it's a substitution.
I'm saying from a defensive standpoint.
Right.
To them, it's normal.
The rule
it's normal that if I come in, if you send in your punt team, I'm sending in my punt return team.
Those are substitutions.
And then if you then.
That's it.
No, if you then make a switch, I am allowed
Auburn
to make a switch too.
They didn't do that. That's what I'm trying to tell you. They didn't do that. If you substitute one player on offense, if you're the offense and you substitute a single human being into the game, the referees have to stop and allow the defense to substitute as well. That happened when the punter was put onto the field. So the punter was put onto the field by Gus Malzahn. Then Alabama made their substitution by putting all of their punt team on the field. That is the two substitutions that took place. After that moment, Nick Saban didn't realize that Bo Nix was still on the field. Now, here's what's ironic about all of this. I don't think there is a chance in hell that Auburn runs that play. If Nick Saban just left his punt return team on the field and played savvy and just said, if he just makes a call, hey, punt safety, safe defense, safe defense, safe defense, and they roll into into a defensive coverage instead of punt return coverage, there's no chance that on fourth and four with a minute and change to go on your own 20-yard line that Bo Nix is running that play. There's no chance they run that play.
I don't trust Gus Malzahn.
But also, mind you, though, Bo Nix, early on in the game, Bo Nix did punt like a 42-yarder early on in the game.
That's what would have happened.
And that would have been very confusing.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they take a timeout and then do the whole regular punt thing.
Absolutely. So,
Saban was outsmarted. It just happens. That's it. That's it. You got beat, dude. Make a field goal.
Now,
he did get screwed at the end of the first half. That whole 1 second left on the clock with the spike of the ball and the field goal for Auburn, that was garbage.
Yeah, if you're Whitlow,
that's garbage.
If you're Whitlow, you have to know. You have to know the clock. Yeah. Like, if there's four Alabama defenders trying to tackle you, you don't need to push the pile. Just fall.
You know what? Block somebody, and then Mac Jones won't throw the ball into Najee Harris's back. Okay, like there are so many other plays. Yeah. Alabama had chances to win the game, and in the final moments, you got outsmarted. It happens.
Well,
Gus Malzahn has beaten him three times. He's the only coach in history to beat Nick Saban three times at Alabama.
But you saw it coming. It lined up for a kicker to kick the field goal, and you just knew it.
Oh, you just knew it.
Here we go.
Hey, can we pour one out for our homie?
Yes.
By the way,
I know he just had to. He had to be beside himself.
That's the only human being on the planet I was thinking about.
Oh, my goodness.
When I was
he had to be beside
play.
Himself.
I wasn't even thinking about you, Marquise, and I love you, man. You're an Alabama guy.
And I texted
You're
him
still
after
with
that.
Us.
I texted him after that. I said, man, it's fitting for Alabama to end the game this way.
And what it does, it opens up the committee's job now as far as the playoff goes. It's very clear. If Georgia wins against LSU, the four teams that are the top four are going to get in. That's it. If Georgia loses,
then
it opens the door for either Oklahoma or Utah, maybe Baylor, but probably unlikely. So we are now down essentially to seven teams for the playoff. And Alabama ain't one of them for the first time during the playoff era. And I think the rest of the country is probably okay with that. I'd like to see the best teams play, but it's hard to argue Alabama's one of the top four right now.
Alabama's not one of the top four teams because Tua's not playing.
Yeah,
they're not one of the top four teams.
If Tua was on there, I might still think they were one of the top four. But he's not, and they're not, and they won't be in. Corey Curtis talking Titans when we return right here on Morning Drive.